Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, we're talking to Paul Montoya. And do you know how long it takes for him to drive to all the transmitter sites he takes care of? It's like almost 30 hours worth of drive. It is 30 hours worth of driving. And there's a lot more. Winterizing your transmitter sites, getting ready, and making sure you're prepared. Great advice coming up with Chris Tobin and Paul Montoya next on TWRT.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By Angry Audio. Audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. By Nautel, keeping you connected with your community with support and webinars, online at nautel.com/webinars. And by MaxConnect Wireless, prioritized high-speed internet service designed for transmitter sites and remote broadcasts.
Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. It's the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower, just like that one over there, except those usually flash and mine's steady. Hi, I'm Kirk Harnack. I'm in the gorgeous, fabulous, luxurious Telos Alliance studio in Nashville, Tennessee. I want to say thanks to the Telos Alliance for sponsoring the show and that letting me, have about an hour off on Thursdays to do the show and to talk to you and to, take your requests and see if we can find, some good people to talk to. And today is absolutely no exception. It's a gorgeous day here in Nashville. Oh my goodness. A beautiful fall day. What is the temperature at the airport? It's 72 degrees, but nobody lives at the airport. So what does it matter? Anyway, it's a beautiful, sunshiny fall day here, and it's a beautiful day in New York City, too. So let's check in with my friend and co-host, Chris Tobin. Hey, Chris, welcome in.
Yes, it is a beautiful day, nice fall day here in New York City, and I'm enjoying it here from a high atop of a balcony in Midtown Manhattan.
You are so high up.
As Paul pointed out earlier before we went live, yes, I'm not on the rooftop today. Sadly, so I know a few folks are upset that I'm not looking over the edge of a building, but today it's just relaxing. I have my simple modern coffee mug that keeps things hot for 4 hours.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah, this is good. But I will be on a rooftop tonight fixing a problem, so.
Really?
Sadly, it's, I've gotten called in to help fix a few things this week. It's up on top of two towers, and it's been fun. So it's a lot of RF stuff I've been doing.
Good deal. Hey, we've got an announcement to make, but first let's go ahead and bring in our guest because I want you to meet him as soon as possible. Paul Montoya is the Director of Engineering at Wyoming Public Radio or Public Media, whichever I happen to say. Paul, welcome into the show. Glad to see you.
Hi, Kirk. Hi, Chris. Thank you for allowing me on today. This will be a lot of fun. This will be good. I'm coming to you from my home studio that I got to put in here. And just in time for COVID-19. Worked well.
Well, I tell you what, we're going to get a quick tour of that studio in a few minutes. I want you to point out a couple of the interesting things around there, including that strange old looking antique that's rolling around and around the background. We'll talk about that in a minute.
That's my wife.
No. We'll have to bleep that
out. I'm in trouble now.
You are. Hey, this week in Radio Tech, the folks at Nautel are again asking us to let you know about, or let you remind you about their continuing series, Transmission Talk Tuesdays. It's their roundtable discussion. It's going to go in all through October. They've got four great topics picked out for October, including what they're going to be talking about, what we're talking about today. They're going to have some different perspectives on it, and that is winterizing. The next week is going to be cloud-based everything, and another one's going to be about HD costs, the cost to go HD. And I know a lot of stations have postponed or avoided doing anything with HD. They weren't sure how they can make money on it. Well, I think it's getting cheaper and easier than ever before. So HD costs. And finally, in October, this should be the fun one. The title is, well, I can't say it. It's a family show. It's stuff that went boom. And if you know Jeff Welton, the host of the show, of the moderator of the roundtables, you know that's what he says a lot, stuff that went boom. So how do you sign up for these webinars? Excuse me, not webinars. They're actually roundtable discussions. But you go to nautel.com/webinars. That's N-A-U-T-E-L, nautel.com/webinars. This is Transmission Talk Tuesday, roundtable discussions. Hey, I got the email today. I went ahead and signed up for all four of them, all four Tuesdays in October. And I would encourage you to as well. Hey, even if you think you can't make them all, go ahead and sign up. You know, you'll get a reminder that the webinar is going to start tomorrow. You get a reminder that the webinar is going to start in 1 hour. So, hey, no reason to miss one. If you're busy, okay, you can catch it on the replay. But if you can participate live, you are welcome to participate in the roundtable. So check it out. And I should mention that this coming one, that's this coming Tuesday, that's we're reminding you about it now. If you live north of the 35th parallel and even some places south of it, the time has come to get serious about the steps to be taken for winterizing. Alex Hartman will be a guest on there. So will Dan Kelly. He's the director of technical services for the Michigan Association of Broadcasters. And they know about cold weather in Michigan, whether you're in the Upper Peninsula or the Lower Peninsula. Check it out. Nautel.com/webinars. And we hope to see you there. All right. We're going to jump right into a terrific show with Paul Montoya. Paul, I guess you and I got to meet by video a few weeks ago. Back at the beginning of COVID, you talked to us about remote operations, and then we did a follow-up about that. How about if you can – we're going to talk about getting ready for winter. You know, winter's coming, brace yourselves and all that, and I'm looking forward to the advice you're given. But I got to ask about the studio, though. Can you just give us a little – we'll put you on a wide shot, and you get just tell us what's around you there.
Well, yeah, I wish I could push the camera out. I had my camera operators asleep, but it's been kind of a fun studio to put together because it's actually built around a house that I built. The house that I built here is actually a bed and breakfast, which is my later in life ambition to get out of radio and run a bed and breakfast. My wife is running it now since I'm doing work for Wyoming Public Radio. And I've been doing that for about 4 or 5 years, and I'll probably continue to do that for some time. But I've got 7,000 vinyl records over here to my right.
Holy
and I don't think you've ever seen that, but they're records, albums that I've carted around in boxes for 22 years. I haven't had them out. And finally, a year ago, I got to pull them out, and I've got a decent turntable. I've got an SP-10 Mark II, Mark II, which if you remember those were kind of the standard for broadcast for a number of years after the Gates turntables and things like that we used to use. And then, of course, you see in the background, that's actually something new for me, is that's a Atari 5050 Mark II. And the primary reason I have that is I have so many old tapes from the 70s and 80s that, King Biscuit Flower Hour and old American Top 40s and things like that. We're losing all of those because of degradation of tape and so forth. And I just want to digitize them. So I've been working on it. That's what I'm doing right now. I'm digitizing one of the shows in the background. So we're watching that happen. So that'll come flying off anytime. And then my newest thing, I got rid of my analog board, and a lot of folks are familiar with the Behringer series. And, you know, Behringer used to be kind of cheap, but they've been kind of innovative lately. And they've come out with this XR18 board that back here is a hub for it, that box turned the other way. And that's where all the connections are made, ties into whatever Surface computer that you have that's touchscreen. And it's the first time I've used it. I do a morning show out of here, actually, for Wyoming Public Media. I do the morning show for Wyoming Sounds, which is a AAA format, which is an old love of mine. It's kind of what I cut my teeth on in the day. So that's kind of it. That's a little bit of the tour. I won't go into any details, but that's about it.
That Behringer is pretty interesting. I noticed that it's got what's called the XR18. It's got 18 inputs, but it's also got Ethernet. It's got Wi-Fi built in. It's got MIDI in and out. It's got USB. And then do you know what this – I'm not familiar with many Behringer products after having some disappointing products from them back 20 years ago. But like you said, things have gotten better now. But what is their Ultranet? What does that connector mean? Any idea?
Their Ultranet – is specifically, this board is great for what I do for production and on-air work, but it also is a good live board. And the Ultranet is essentially their monitoring system, their in-ear monitor system, essentially an Ethernet-delivered monitoring system that you can use on stage. Of course, I don't really use that. We do actually have a stage here, at the bed and breakfast, and we've done some outdoor concerts this summer, and I did get to use that for the first time live. And one of the nice deals is that not only does it tie into something like this, but I can use a tablet device and actually do live mixing like you see quite a bit. What was it? It was the 32-channel Behringer that I guess was real popular, mainly for live mixing. I can't remember what it was called. I think it might have been the X32, possibly. And you still see that at a lot of live venues and people doing their tablet mixing that way.
Indeed. I've seen that quite a few times. In fact, we've had a guest on the show a few times. Shane Toven has done mixing. Oh, sure. Oh, and so is Chris Tarr. He's at the community station that he engineered for. He would sit way in the back and get that done. So that's cool.
Great way to go nowadays.
I want to ask you, you said that turntable, that's an SP10, which was the beefy one of the series, of the Technics series. And I want to ask Chris Toben if he remembers this, or Paul, maybe you do. There was a rock station I worked for that bought some SP10s, and I was told that they were sold on them when the Technics sales guy came by, set up an SP10, and stood on it, put his feet, stood up on the turntable and put it to the lowest speed. I guess that was 33 and a third, and have somebody push the start stop button, and it spun him around. Now, he didn't do it very long, but he said the motor here is so powerful and the thing is so beefy, it'll hold the weight of me anyway and let me go around. Well, Chris, did you ever hear about that, or Paul?
I have heard stories, but I've never tried it. I have two SP10s in our studios. And they do have, well, by design, the SP10s do have a very beefy direct drive motor, and you can feel it when you try to slip cue. Good luck if you don't have felt underneath the vinyl. But it's very, very, very robust machine. Yeah, absolutely. The people standing on the turntable, though, I've heard that with the old gates.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I was just going to say that, Chris, because the Gates turntables, if you remember, they normally came in a cabinet. And these were the old, was it 16-inch, the large platters they used to have?
Yes.
They used for cutting. And I remember in high school, we actually had one at one of the high school radio stations that I helped with. And it literally had, I mean, it was a huge electric motor that was belt driven underneath it. And yes, we did use to stand on that and rotate people. I don't think you could do that with the Mark 10. I'd be real surprised.
You don't want to break it.
No, I don't want to try it. It will start in an eighth of a turn, which, you know, anything less than a quarter of a turn was really important in the day when we were slip cueing records. And it does not, it's one of the, I think it's the only Technics turntable that doesn't come with a tone arm and stylus. It actually is just the turntable. You supply your own. I'm using an Audio Technica tone arm on it.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. Yeah. I see. Yeah. Remember the SP10 and maybe the SP15 didn't come with a tone arm either, but the SP25 certainly did. And then there's the 1200 series as well. Or maybe the 25 didn't either. Yeah. I had a station where I had 25s and those wooden tone arms. I forget what brand that they were. Oh, well. Hey, but we didn't come here to talk about tone arms. Let's move up to our topic. And our producer, Suncast, has a little syllabus for us, because we're going to cover several important topics here. Suncast, if you could toss that syllabus up there. Today, we're going to be learning about generators, fuel and maintenance, HVAC filters and maintenance, towers, guy tensioning and lighting, the backup STL audio, transmitters for your backup and aux sites. Boy, the building itself, this is important, because I've certainly come to buildings that were in bad shape. The vehicle needed to get to the sites, access, gates, locks, right-of-ways, and backup help. Now, you didn't need me to read all that to you, but I wanted you to know the things that we're going to be covering. And you know what I need to do? I probably ought to – let me take a picture of that so I can have that list handy. Here we go. Bam. How's that for high tech? All right, I'm going to have that list handy. So, Paul, why don't we kind of jump right into it? And Suncast, if we're talking about something for which there is an appropriate picture, and I think there may be a generator picture, but if there's not, no problem. Just toss it up there. Okay. Well, Paul, let's kind of jump into it. And we don't have to go in the order that they're in. Start with whatever topic you like. I guess preface it by saying, why, Paul? Why are you qualified to talk to us about winterizing your transmitter site?
Well, I'm probably not. There's probably people more qualified than me to talk about this, but I've been doing radio now for 45 years. And like a lot of you out there, you know, we've seen just about everything, I think. Most of my time has been in mountainous situations. A lot of times with cold winters, sometimes not. I worked in Las Vegas and Phoenix for a while, and we didn't have snow there. But what I would like to talk about today really isn't necessarily a lot of times something you do at winter. I tend to do that because that's a seasonal change when you're going to really be getting into some difficult situations. But anything on this list could apply just toward what we used to call an annual inspection. And we kind of do it in a, when we do these, we do it in a circuit. We've got, essentially got 32 sites around our state for the network. And I know a lot of folks out there don't have near as many sites, but most of what we're going to be talking about really has to do with specific things we need to look at the site that sometimes we forget about because things just keep running. And a lot of the times, you know, it's a situation that we don't have the personnel to do a lot of this. But if we can at least take a chance to once a year get the things and at least check them over, then they won't catch us off guard. And I think that's kind of really what we're talking about in this. What I put first on the list, Kirk and Chris, was something I know both of you really value, and that is generators. And sometimes the simplest thing is just remembering that we got to get it fueled up. I don't do my own maintenance. I'm not that great. I'm not a old wrench guy. I don't work on my own cars anymore and things like that. So I leave that up to a company to come in and do the servicing. But we got to make sure that it's scheduled and that it really gets done. Last thing we want is when we have that major power outage due to some type of storm, have it fail because it's out of fuel or because something didn't get changed, an air filter didn't get changed, so forth. So, you know, having that generator ready is really important. And, you know, not all of our sites, in our case, have generators. A lot of them, we just kind of limp along. And if it's been pretty reliable power, if power goes off, we just deal with it and we're off the air at that site for that time being. We have pretty good UPS units at all of our sites, and that'll carry us through the bumps, but a lot of times it won't sustain us without that generator coming on. Our primary sites in what we would consider larger cities, and you got to remember, biggest cities in Wyoming are about 80,000 people, so we're not talking huge cities that, but we'll try to keep generators at those type of sites. But I kind of think that's important. I don't know, Chris, do you have generators at most of your sites?
Yes, actually, we have a generator at our studios. And next week, we'll be doing our quarterly preventive maintenance checkout, load test, and everything else. At our transmitter facility, because we're in a building, the building does provide generator power for the broadcasters that are leasing space. So, both of my sites, every station I've worked at, we've always had a generator. And it's always been the weakest link because nobody wants to pay for something that's out of sight. They don't get it. But you should do when the snow comes or the rain comes, the utility power pole gets hit by a car from somebody driving off the road through the ice, so which I have experienced on 3, 4, 7 occasions in my career. So, I make sure those generators are nice and clean and working very well. I mean, seriously clean. You'd be surprised how quickly they catch dirt and leaves and debris inside the cabinets if they're outdoors. So you should check the entire housing.
Paul, I've got a question about maintenance companies. And I agree with you. You know, I used to change oil in my own cars, and cars have gotten more sophisticated and I've gotten older. So, you know, I'll let somebody else do that. And I never changed my own oil in generators. We would always have a contract for that. So I get that. But if you're an engineer for a station and it's your responsibility to make sure that the generators do get checked right, is there any kind of way you need to deal with or specify to the maintenance company? I mean, I didn't have much interaction with them, but I would like to obviously make sure, hey, dude, make sure that this has got to come on when the weather is absolutely the worst. It's got to work when everything around us is just awful. It's got to come on, and it's got to run, you know, for maybe 20 minutes, maybe 20 hours, maybe 20 days, with fuel, of course. So do you have some advice on what you can tell to your generator maintenance company so that they understand how critical this is to you?
Well, I think you spelled it out exactly right, really, Kirk, is that you've got to let them know that you depend on this. This is what keeps you on the air. And that if it doesn't come on, I wouldn't expect a new annual agreement next year. We're a little bit limited because we don't have the number of companies that you might in a larger city to actually pick from. So a lot of times we're limited by that. We're also limited by the type of generator, and we do have various brands, everything from Onan to Wagner to all the standard brands, Kohler. And so we have a variety of different generators and variety of ages too. So we try to find people that are a lot of times tied into those specific brands so that they know them well. You know, things that typically will go out will be like controller cards and things like that, that sometimes just take a lightning hit, and a lot of times you don't realize that they've gone out. One thing we try to do is we try to exercise all of our generators. We also have notification within our remote control units whether they're running or not. So we can kind of log that and also see the status of where they're at. Not all the generators we have that type of capability. If they're older, they may not have the contact closures to provide us with status information whether they're running or not. We try to exercise them. I won't say we always exercise them under load. We probably should. We'll normally do a load test with them at least once a year, but we don't do that on a weekly basis. We'll normally just make sure that the generator's running.
Talk to me. We got to do a break here real quick, but talk to me about fuel and fuel additives. You guys are in a pretty cold climate there. Down south where I am, maybe there are other concerns like mold or whatever bacteria growing in the diesel fuel. What are your concerns there, and how do you make sure that the fuel is going to flow and provide good energy to the engine?
Well, you know, at these altitudes and the cold weather systems, yeah, normally a anti-gelling additive is important to diesel. Now, I will say any generators that I've put in, most of ours are all propane. That presents its own situations. We have one site, believe it or not, and we share a lot of sites with Wyoming Public Television. We have one site that we put in this last year outside of Sheridan that's up on a mountain like a lot of our sites. And believe it or not, we put the generator in and a 500-gallon propane tank, and we contacted the propane companies in the Sheridan area, and none of them would go up to the mountaintop. None of them had four-wheel drive, had capability to do it. What we ended up doing, believe it or not, and I give credit to the folks at Wyoming Public Television because they actually handled this, is they actually mounted the 500-gallon propane tank on a trailer. And we literally drive it down the hill a good chunk of the way, have the propane company fill it, and we haul it back up to the site. Now, that's a little unusual. But, I have had cases. I remember a case in Denver that we did have a diesel generator when I was working in Denver. And it was on – it had to go on power online. And after 2 days of being offline because of some cold weather snow conditions that we had there, it's taking some lines down, we had to get fuel up to it. I remember lugging, giant gas cans, on snowshoes up the side of a mountain. And, sometimes you got to do what you have to do. But we were able to stay on the air. We actually reduced our transmitter power so that we wouldn't use as much generator fuel. But it can be an issue. Fuel can be a real difficult situation.
We're talking to Paul Montoya. He's the director of engineering at Wyoming Public Radio. I'm Kirk Harnack, along with Chris Tobin. And we're talking about getting winterized at your transmitter sites, or maybe at the studio, too, so you're ready for winter. And this applies, hey, even me to my stations down in Mississippi, because we do get icing and sometimes some nasty, nasty weather. It's our 511th episode, and brought to you in part by Josh Bone and the guys at Max Connect Wireless. This is the same 4G LTE modem I've been showing you for about a year now, almost a year, and it is prioritized data for your transmitter site, for getting I'm sorry, 500, episode 512. Thanks, Suncast. I appreciate that. I'll get it right. But this is what we've been talking about for a year now. Prioritize data for your remote broadcast, for your transmitter site, for an emergency STL system. These things work great. And I just had the pleasure of trying out a different model. This is the PepWave 4G LTE modem. Gee, this form factor seems to work pretty well, right? This is the cradle point. And this is the PepWave. And I'm dealing with a great engineer named Micah Dempsey at Bone Broadcast. And Micah said, Kirk, we've got this PepWave that some people are using, and we'd like some step-by-step instructions as to how to set up a port forward on this. And hey, you guys at Telos can publish this if you like. And we're going to publish it too to help people who need to push an RTP stream to maybe a transmitter site or maybe back to the studio for doing a live remote broadcast. And you can do that. I'll be documenting this. I got to try this out this past weekend. I was visiting my dad in Georgia, and lo and behold, I was doing some important work for him, and the internet died. Now, the Wi-Fi didn't die, but the internet died, and I had nothing. I thought, what am I going to do? And my cell phone coverage there is just terrible. So I thought, wait a minute, I've got this with me. What a great time to check it out. So I plugged up the PepWave on Max Connect Wireless, and with it, it takes it about 2.5 minutes to get synced up. And once I did that, though, I had great data. And I know it's got a cap of how of the bandwidth of how fast it runs, but I didn't notice anything. It just ran great for me. I got done, you know, some banking and some other things for my dad, and got it taken care of. One of the extra cool things about all this Max Connect Wireless stuff is, I'm going to cover it up here, is that they have a fixed IP address for your service so that you can use it at the transmitter site to shoot RTP streams to that. Yeah, fixed IP address. Anything you need a fixed IP address for, you've got it with Max Connect Wireless. And your data has priority over everybody else's data, except for first responders. But you can, as Chris Tobin knows, you can be right next to a big stadium full of fans on their cell phones, and your data goes through just fine. Check it out, Max Connect Wireless. com. Thanks a lot, Josh Bone and Micah Dempsey, for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. All right, it's Kirk Harnack and Chris Tobin, episode 512, and we're here with Paul Montoya. Paul, we got a big list of things to keep talking about. Hey, Kirk, I guess.
You know, one thing, since you were just talking about Max Connect, this would be a good segue into one of the other items on our list, and that's backup STL.
Go ahead.
We do a lot of our STL to most of our sites, since we've got a pretty large network, is through Ku-band satellite. Maybe we can put up the slide with the Ku-band satellite dish
there. Oh yeah, that's quite a picture. Yeah, I'm sure Suncast has to go punch it up and make it look pretty.
So we'll hang on. I hate to give him no notice. He probably wasn't ready for that. But you know, sometimes things go wrong with Ku-band satellite, just like you would with 950 STL. You can see.
Whoa! I'd say that's wrong.
Yeah, we get a little bit of wind up here, so once in a while you might get something like that. It just, you know, we've had two dishes this has happened to, where the panel is just delaminated from the frame due to high wind just pounding on it. But when you do lose that, we will normally fail over to IP. We have IP at all except one of our sites right now. And, you know, going to something like the Max Connect, like you're talking about, sometimes it's the thing that really saves a day. And having that static IP address, you know, you can't get that with, you know, any type of standard cradle point. But when you're set up with the prioritized circuit and also a static IP like Max Connect provides, then you can actually tie directly into that site pretty easily with any audio that you want to feed. So we'll use all types of codec devices. Some of my favorite are some of the Telos Alliance boxes, but they'll work with a number of different things. And it's a great way to provide some type of backup STL, because you never know what's going to happen. And like I said, whether it's a 950 link or maybe you're using, do you remember equalized phone lines?
Oh, yeah. I remember equalizing them for the phone company when they no longer had people who were able to do that. And I was I got hold of the Tellabs instructions sheet. I thought, wait a minute. Wow. This isn't that bad. You set the level at 1 kilohertz, and then you set the level at 10 kilohertz, and you iterate those. And when you're done iterating those, it'll be right. And you know what? I think there was a little bump adjustment for like 30 hertz or 50 hertz. And you know what? It worked great.
But you had to get a dry, unloaded pair, didn't you? You had to make sure that they had unloaded the pair and it had to be normally, what would they call them? Were they called, I think you could order in what was called a DC circuit that used to be used for the old dial-up remote controls, but you could also use those and equalize your own audio too. But we digress.
In the town where I lived in Richmond, Kentucky, we could order a metering circuit elsewhere in Kentucky too. And they were really, I want to say we paid like $12 a month for a metering circuit. And then we equalized it ourselves, and you had to hope and pray there were no loading coils on there. Or you could buy a case of cigarettes for the telephone tech and say, I'll trade you these if you'll remove the loading coils. Either that or a month's supply of beer, but we both digress. Yeah,
whatever works.
Let's see. So we talked about having backup there. What let's see, what's another topic we were looking at here? How about towers? You know, that wind reminds me of tower issues.
Yeah, and you know, most of the towers, it's different. I mean, we don't have towers on buildings like you do, Chris. We have towers that we call mountains, and our tallest site we have is actually about 12,000 feet above average terrain, and up there we have a short tower. I should have sent a picture of that. We have a tower that's maybe 50 feet or so, and a three bay antenna up on it, and it may have a short set of guys or it might be freestanding, but I think sometimes we forget the maintenance now that we used to always do on towers, especially guide towers. I'm just kind of curious to see how often people are doing guide tensioning when you've got a 300 foot, a 500 foot tower, maybe multiple layers, that lighting that goes on, is required on the towers. Are we really checking that, checking connections? I mean, these are things that a lot of times we won't do and we'll contract out to do, but I think sometimes tower maintenance is an afterthought. Here in Wyoming, we've got a lot of towers, like I said, up on mountains, and they may only be 100 feet high. But I would say in the last 3 years, I've known of three different towers that have gone down in a good windstorm. I would dare say that most of that was just due to maybe guy wires not being checked and tensioned properly, or checking guy anchors. But they do come down, and it's something we got to look at. And that's even beyond any of the icing conditions that sometimes we get. We don't get as much icing here in Wyoming, but our neighbors in South Dakota and Nebraska, they'll have 1,400-foot, 1,600-foot towers come down just due to ice. A lot of times there's not much you can do about that, but the tensioning part of it, and you know, even just checking hardware on towers, the bolts, are they all tight? Are they all there? How many towers have we gone up or seen that were missing bolts because they vibrated out over time? So there's a lot we really have to look at. And I know, again, it's a factor sometimes of time and personnel. But if we don't want to be caught by surprise, it's something we have to do, really.
Maybe Chris can add to this too, but I was thinking that most of the issues that I've seen or that have happened to towers that I wouldn't say I'm responsible for in our company, I'm kind of not responsible for them. But the problems that I've seen with towers, at least in the South, have been mostly solvable at ground level. Because I was about to mention, well, you know, an engineer can only check so much stuff at ground level. You got to hire a tower crew to check stuff up high. But I'm thinking we've had a number of failures, mishaps, things going wrong that could have been prevented by good ground inspection. Guy anchor points that have weeds or tree trunks growing up around them or have become waterlogged, and now maybe the anchor point itself is sitting in water. And by the way, concrete will float in water. So if you've got a guy anchor point that used to be dry and now it's surrounded by water, look out. You may have a real problem there. Rusted guy wires. And the other thing to note is that if you've got any electric stuff outside, like a tower light flasher or the sunset relay, you know, the dawn to dusk, dusk to dawn relay, those are outside where the temperature changes every day. In fact, it's called diurnal heating or cooling. And so you've got you know, compression connections with the wires coming in every single day. You're going to warm up. Hey, if it's hot outside, it may be 120 degrees inside that box. And then at night, it may go down to 65 or 70. And then during the winter, it may get up to 40 and go down to 10 degrees. And this every single day of warming, cooling, warming, cooling. And you know, that's no good for a screw against an electrical wire. Chris, I want to see if you got any thoughts about that too. Most of your stuff I would think is indoors, but maybe I'm wrong.
Well, my current tower situation is I don't own it. We're on a building. But they do inspect it every year. They have a tower company come in. They go up from top to bottom, look for the galvanizing bolts, all kinds of things, loose cable connections. You know, we've got several broadcasters up there with huge, large transmission lines, it's both TV and radio. But in my career, in the time I've worked at places where we did own the towers, own the property, we would make it a regular yearly inspection for a crew to come in, just a physical inspection. It's a two-person crew, up and down. But monthly, we would check at the tower site itself. And guy anchors, the guy wires, the fences around the guy anchors, which is very important for safety, for all kinds of things, insurance, everything else, FCC requirements. You could tell, if you're smart about it, you take pictures, you keep in a binder at the transmitter site, and you refer to them and look at the condition. What I used to do is spray paint a line, like a water line, on the anchor along the grass, or the dirt, the soil. And if there is any heaving, you know, freezing, there's a name for it, I got it wrong. But, you know, wintertime, the expansion, contraction of the soil, and you could check to see if any changes are taking place. It's just a quick inspection. If you do it right, and you're smart about it, it should take you one morning or an afternoon, not a full day, not 3 days out at the transmitter site. You go in, you look around, boop, 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 key points, you're done. That's how it works. If you see water stains, noticing water stains in your building, you should start looking around as to why. Concrete's real good about showing that off real fast. Same is true for your generator. You know, it's generated on a concrete slab. Is it high above a floodplain? Is the concrete slab maybe only 6 inches above the soil line? Are there any cracks at the edges, the corners where the weight, when the generator starts, it vibrates and creates a crack? Because what happens then is during the cold season, that water migrates in, expands during freezing, cracks it even more, contracts, expands, and before you know it, chunks of concrete are falling from beneath your generator. Yeah. Or maybe even your building frame. But these are little things you don't notice if you're not doing it once a month. Now, if you have the luxury of doing it twice a month, it's better. But once a month, you can easily catch things in advance. But nothing replaces a physical tower inspection. I got to do that yearly, minimum yearly.
You're right. Yeah.
That's important. I mean, that's important for pragmatic business policy. Because when you think about it, for insurance reasons, if, heaven forbid, something should happen, the first question that comes out is, when was the last time the structure was inspected?
Yeah.
And if you can't say within 12 months, you're going to have an interesting conversation with a few people, both at City Hall, your attorney's office, your insurance company, you know, the board of directors. There's a lot of things. So it's worth it.
It's your money. You know, one thing we invested in a few years ago that's really helpful, we use it probably more for inspecting a lot of times the FM antennas, but we invested in a drone. And you can take that drone, once you get good at it, and just fly it up and down the tower and look for major issues. I'm not saying it would take the place of somebody actually climbing the tower to actually do an inspection. But by taking that drone up and down, you can look for different problems and situations, maybe having to do with attachments to guy wires and things like that. The one tip I will say about drones is make sure you don't leave your FM transmitter at high power while you're doing this, because as you fly that by that antenna, that drone's going to do whatever it wants. It'll get so swamped by RF. So you don't want that to happen. Lose your drone.
I've got some experience in that regard. And what I found is that the bigger drones, like the big Phantom series from DJI, those have a lot of wires running around inside from one board to another. They got a lot of antennas in there. But I've been flying this Mavic, this DJI Mavic Pro for, over 3 years now. And I've had, not saying no trouble, but I've had very little trouble, more trouble around UHF TV transmitters, and really almost no trouble around FMs, even high power.
Wow.
But still, you make a good point. It doesn't hurt to, if you're the engineer, you can go turn the power down, fly your drone, and then come back.
But I have an up and down.
Well, we fly a Phantom 4, so that's probably why.
There you go. There you go. Yeah. Hey, we've got some really cool things coming up in the next half hour with Paul Montoya. We're talking to Paul. He's the director of engineering at Wyoming Public Radio. And we've got a picture to show you of a vehicle that you will not find south of the Mason-Dixon line. You won't find any of these in Tennessee or Mississippi or Texas, but they sure have them in Wyoming, and that's coming up. Also, a look at a beautiful transmitter building. It looks to me like How to Do It Right. And maps. We've got a couple of maps to show you that I think are just fascinating to show you Paul and his team's travels to check transmitter sites. So all that is coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, episode 512. Our show is brought to you in part by Broadcasters General Store. The website is bgs.cc. Let's see. One of the things that they carry is a very popular item for studios everywhere. It's the Vox Pro. We'll be right back.
Yo, what's up? Live from NAB 2018. Hey, it's Caden. You need to check out Wheatstone and Vox Pro 7.1. The upgrades are amazing. If you're a jock, if you're a talent, producer, whatever, a morning show, everyone knows Vox Pro. Everyone uses Vox Pro. Everyone loves Vox Pro. But now the features for this year, 2018, on 7.1 are amazing. If you're using version 4, 5, 6, and you go to 7, this is exactly what you're missing right here. The features are a game changer. It's going to cut down your editing time by like 80% depending on what you use Vox Pro for. And with version 7.1, introducing unlimited practic button bars right here, hotkeys right here. I'm going to show you coming out of a song.
Bad things. It's a lot of bad things that they wish and wish and wish.
So you're coming out of your song?
Yeah.
Start your next song right here. It's basically an entire production room right on Vox Pro. So it's the Vox Pro we know and love with a ton more features. And now this is the ultimate game changer right here, effect macros. So instead of hitting your effects button bar and going up here using your mouse for every effect, you do it right here with one click of the mouse, and you're going to cut down your editing time by about 80% without even touching this new sexy black controller. Check it out right here. Wheatstone Vox Pro 7.1 at NAB in Vegas 2018.
And even though the Caden's message there is a couple of years old, the Vox Pro story is still the same and still very innovative. Check it out from Broadcasters General Store. The website is bgs.cc, and you can get not only Vox Pro, but all kinds of broadcast products there. Whatever you need, I'm telling you, these BGS folks get it for you. And maybe you're adding a little video to your radio studio. Talk to BGS at bgs.cc or call them at 352-622-7700. Thank you, BGS. Broadcasters General Store. I've been buying from them for, my goodness, it's been 30 years plus. Back when I was doing work with Sam Phillips in Nashville, Tennessee, Memphis, Tennessee. I've been buying from Broadcast General Store. Thanks a lot for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, we're going to move on through. We're talking with winterizing and things you need to do to get ready for winter with Paul Montoya, because he knows about this. He lives in Wyoming. Paul, you want to cover this vehicle that I guess, well, when do you use this crazy tracked vehicle?
We use it when we need it. There's, you know, believe it or not, we'll bring up the slide here of the track vehicle. But yeah, essentially it's a 4x4 that it's actually a larger 4x4 that seats four people, or a lot of times it's one or two people with a lot of equipment in the back seat. There is a rear area there, but essentially it's a 4x4 with wheels taken off and tracks put on. It's a fairly complicated system to take wheels off and put the tracks on, so we normally leave the tracks on year round. Mm-hmm. It's not like we use it for a four wheeler during the summer, but this will get us to a lot of sites that maybe you don't want to use a snowmobile or a smaller vehicle because you're hauling equipment up there, and it'll get you to where you need to go. Now, I will say if the snow gets to be 3 or 4 feet deep, which a lot of our sites do, a lot of times we still can't get to the site even with the track vehicle. In that case, we normally will rent or borrow a snowcat. A lot of times, if it's there's one site in Jackson Hole, which we actually take the ski lift up, and then we'll hike across a saddle with snowshoes to the site, and and get to the site that way. So you kind of have to do what you have to do. We have a few sites that have towers within the towns, and it's not too difficult to get to. But a lot of the sites, we required a specialized vehicle to get there. There was a case before I actually started Wyoming Public Radio, they actually used one of the people down below the mountain, a couple of their horses, and it got up to the site by horseback. I wasn't on that trip. I'm not great with horses, so even though I'm a cowboy, I won't do that.
That actually sounds pretty good. Sounds better than snowshoes going across the saddle from the top of the ski lift. I like the horse idea. That track vehicle, I'm curious about that. So it's a four-wheel drive vehicle. It looked like a Jeep or something like that. And you put these track assemblies on. They do look complicated. But that's kind of fits between a four-wheel drive truck and a snowcat, which is kind of the ultimate for getting to hard to get at places in the snow, isn't it?
Yeah, the idea behind a snowcat is you have a lot more surface area to them because you've got tracks that maybe span. Well, the ones they use at commercial ski resorts sometimes can be 10 feet wide as they go up and down in groomed mountains. Most of the ones that we will use are typically a vehicle with maybe 8 feet at the most, but it'll be track all the way across, so it'll stay on top of the snow and get you up just about over anything. These are typically the 4x4 type vehicles. Ours happens to be a Ranger by Polaris. Can-Am makes them. There's a number of people that make these. Honda makes a really good one also. But they're your typical 4x4s that you'll see people use out on farms or maybe doing four-wheeling during the summer out in the on the terrain. So they're a pretty stock vehicle, so they're not terribly expensive like a snowcat. But then you put the tracks on. Tracks are about $2,000 per track, so they're not cheap. But the nice thing is this is now a vehicle that's pretty portable, so we'll actually haul it around on a typical car trailer and can take it to pretty well any site and just offload it and be ready to go. It is handy for things like that.
When Chris goes to a transmitter site in New York, he's got credentials. He's got to have his stuff together. When I go to a transmitter site in Mississippi, I mean, okay, if we forget the key, it's not a big deal. We just drive back to the town and get to the radio station and get the key. It's not that big a deal. But if you're going to take a snowcat or a track vehicle or even your four wheel drive up some windy, windy mountains, you got to be prepared. You got to have everything. Do you use a checklist or what's got to be checked? What's got to be fixed? Hey, last time we were there, the dehydrator was looking bad or whatever it might be. Or there was an amplifier pallet on the transmitter that was looking shaky. We need to take a new one up there. I mean, how do you workflow plan your day, your activity at a site? And how do you do that safely, knowing how much you can do? Can you stay until it gets dark, or do you need to come down before the sun goes down? Kind of what's your plan for going to a site that's really tough to get to?
Well, like you said, a checklist is really important. A lot of times also the monitoring of the site is important. You want to have an inkling of what's going on. We use the Inovonic 635 monitors at most of our sites, which are great because, we have sites that are 400 miles away, so we can't listen to the signal off the air. By having something like the Inovonic device, we can actually monitor off the air, even the HD signals. 12 of our sites have HD and HD2 and HD3 at them. So you want to kind of figure out what's going on before you head out. Typically, at a minimum, we try to take a spare of something up. A lot of times we figure we're not going to be able to work on it right there. We're fortunate in our particular network because we have no tube transmitters left anymore. So a lot of it is modules. A lot of it is spare parts that way that we know we're going to be able to swap out. The good thing about most of the high-power solid-state transmitters is even if you have a failure, it might just be a module or a power supply. Very seldom does the whole, at least in our experience, has the whole transmitter gone down. If we do have a transmitter go down, we will take spare transmitters. I mean, nowadays in a fairly small package, you can take a 3.5-kilowatt transmitter up with you. If we know that it's a problem with the audio getting there, we might take, like a Max Connect and, a codec up there if we don't have some type of backup audio already running. So from that standpoint, we try to take what we have. But I do have kits put together, and all of the crew really does, where there's a certain amount of cables and interfaces, of course, tools. Not as much test equipment anymore. It's funny because a lot of the test equipment we've taken in the past has been replaced by these guys. These, you know, smartphones have so much capability in them now. I mean, this is for another topic sometime, but we do a lot of satellite dish alignment with all the KU dishes and so forth that we have at the sites. On this, I now have my dish alignment software. I have my inclinometer. And I have my compass. So I no longer have to take those items in a separate box if I know I'm going to have to align a dish. So it's an amazing time we're living in because, I mean, most of us, Chris and Kirk, you're old enough to remember the days where you were hauling oscilloscopes and spectrum analyzers up. Now between a laptop and a cell phone, we have a lot of the test equipment that we need to take to sites anymore. But yeah, you do have to be ready and be ready for anything. You were asking about how late you typically would work. Yeah, we try to take provisions to the point where if we had to stay overnight, we could. But we typically don't. One thing we do take to most of our mountain sites that I bet, Chris, you probably don't take is we take bear spray with us. Because you never know when we might come across a bear while we're out in the woods.
Well, I will say we have different types of wild animals here in the city, depending on the neighborhood with towers. It may not be bear spray, but there are some sprays involved.
Oh, my goodness. Oh.
That's great. We've run into 3 rattlesnakes this year at sites. It hasn't been me. It's been some of my other guys have gone to sites, but we've had 3 rattlesnakes come out from under buildings. And I know a lot of people in Arizona and some of that area can relate to that.
Talk to me and Chris, if you would, Paul, about access in terms of gates and locks. And do you come across situations where maybe it's a shared site and some doofus hooked it up in such a way that now my lock is rendered not usable? How do you solve this kind of problem? Do you have a clever way, or is it just the occasional battle with people doing dumb stuff?
I think that's universal across anywhere in the world. Is you have these chains of locks on these gates and somebody's taking you out of the chain. We take the universal key with us, and that's a pair of bolt cutters. If we have to, I mean, if we have to get in, we do carry those with us. And if somebody's screwed up, we have to find some way to get to the site. Most of our sites, without giving away a lot of security and so forth, we have normally key boxes at the sites, and we do have different codes at all the different sites. So we do have keys typically there. A lot of the gates will have combination locks or whoever accesses through. Some of our sites are Forest Service or BLM land, and they might have a master code that all the people using that site might have to get into the site. But there is an occasion. I got the one site, and they had a lockbox access that they had provided, and they changed the lockbox out and forgot to tell me. And here I was, dead of the winter. I have a picture of it, and there's just icicles coming off everything. And you know, I was in that track vehicle and got into the site and found out I couldn't get into the transmitter building. Fortunately, I had cell service, so I was able to call the landlord of the building we were at, and he knew I wasn't very happy. Let's put it that way. But he did track down the new combination I was able to get in. But it can be frustrating. Access can be difficult. We do put cameras at all of our sites too. We use a lot of the Ubiquiti cameras, and we do put cameras at the sites. Not only for security, but a lot of times to see what the weather conditions are like. Like I said, some of our sites were 300-400 miles away, and you hate to get to the site and find out the weather is a lot different than it is where you are located in the office and the studios down south.
That's a good point. Speaking of the cameras then and the other IP connectivity things you're mentioning, so at your sites, I guess, do you get some of your IP connectivity from your partners in television?
Yes and no. It's a combination. I would say probably with Wyoming Public Television, they do run a statewide microwave network, which is mm-hmm. very handy. We've got our own VLAN that's separate from their VLAN with that network, and that's great. And that gets all the way back to our studio. They actually have a link down to our studio in Laramie. But I will say we'll use Max Connects where we have to, but most of ours is actually through wireless internet providers. I used to have a small wireless internet service company before I got into Wyoming Public Radio, and I really got to know what the reliability was like if it's a well-run network. Now, that's the big if. One of the companies we use is actually based in the state, but they've pretty well engulfed the state now with sites, and I found it to be very reliable. I mean, typically, I'm not going to need, like video would with, 100 meg up, 100 meg down. If I have a good 10 meg, 10 by 5 circuit at a site, that's normally enough for the video because I'm not running a huge bandwidth on those cameras. It's fine for remote control, and typically I can do two or three channels of backup audio. Like I said, we've got three services we provide, so some of the sites are HD, and normally I can actually put backup audio on there too and do all of that in a 10 by 5 circuit. As long as that circuit's reliable, that's what I'm really counting on. We've eliminated DSL. DSL, at least in this part of the world, is pretty well useless. The reliability factor is just too poor. A lot of times the lines, if you had a phone line going up to a site, is 50 years old, and the copper was too poor to really support DSL anyway.
Let's if we could take a quick look at our final pictures here. We have a building picture I'd like to examine because I promised that we would look at this building. Tell me about what we're looking at here.
Yeah, this is a this is something I actually discovered. I actually built our house / bed and breakfast out of insulated concrete form, and it pretty well sold me on it. The picture to the left, you can kind of see a cutaway view because I did this mid-stucco when we were building this particular building. But the entire building is insulated concrete form, which is kind of like styrofoam Lego blocks that you fill with concrete, if you want to look at it that way. They have a plastic membrane built into them to attach drywall and so forth. And being styrofoam in their design, the synthetic stucco, you use a synthetic stucco base to it and then put the colored stucco over it. And it's virtually impervious to anything liquid or even something structural hitting it. It's very, very strong material. It's not like your typical concrete stucco of years past. One thing you have to do is wherever you're going to put a port through, you got to make sure and build a form around that. So for your HVAC and so forth, you can see in the finished picture to the right, we use typically in these buildings, a barred wall mount HVAC unit. And you can see the ports to the right that are covered up there that are the ports for the HVAC. The one on the left is an emergency air intake fan. And there's actually an exhaust fan on the backside of the building that you don't see. But the one advantage, in the past, I always liked center block. But as most of you know, center block will weep water through it. I remember a case in Las Vegas. I had a center block wall, and I came in. We were having some issues, and we had some pretty heavy monsoon-type rains in Las Vegas, and the floor was just full of water. There's a lot of water that had gotten into the equipment. Now, you can't paint center block. You normally have to use an epoxy type paint on the outside of the building. But I don't think anything really beats this synthetic stucco over the insulated concrete form. Like I said, if you have to go back and drill a hole through it later, you're getting a concrete drill out, and it can be a real chore to actually get through it.
You got to plan those ports.
It actually is, to get it through. And then, a lot of times we'll use a just a ICF or not ICF, but a manufactured I-joist for the roof of the building. In our case, we typically will insulate it with like an R 45 insulation, a real thick insulation, and that keeps the cold out. And at the same time during the summer, it'll keep the heat out too if you're generating a lot of heat within the building. So I've really found this style building to be very good. We have a couple sites where we have some of the manufactured buildings that normally have the impregnated epoxy type panels put on them with the aggregate built onto them. And those have been good, but you know, lately we've had issues with those becoming delaminated from the plywood structure behind it, and they'll actually start to come off. We've had to drive lag bolts through them just to keep the panels on. And, you know, typically those are wood frame, sometimes 2x4, sometimes 2x6, but they just don't, you know, they're expensive buildings for what I think you get. And they are on a skid, so the advantage is if you do decide you have to move it, that's great. But we don't move a lot of our sites. And doing a concrete slab in these ICF buildings really seems to be pretty good. So we're starting to do more of that now. And so far they've proven to be pretty sturdy and reliable as far as buildings.
We've got to, we're just running short on time. Let's take a quick look at one of these maps, Paul, and you can kind of tell me what are we looking at here with this map. There's Laramie in the bottom right,
yeah,
along with Cheyenne.
That's the route I'm going to take next week. I'm going to be doing the Eastern Tour. And it's what does it say there? It's about probably 1,100-mile trip, I believe. Right. So I'll take a week and then hit all of those sites. And then we have the Western Tour, which is the other map. And we essentially do the same type of routing through the western part of the state. But we're hitting a number of cities as we go through there. So
now I've seen a map of the subways that Chris takes. There's the Western. Wow, look at that. 18, almost 19 hours worth of driving if you don't stop. And the whole point is to stop at the transmitter sites.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I normally do that in about a week. So 5-6 days, you know, and stop and stay overnight.
Chris, that map, I'm not saying it scares me, but wow, that's a lot of driving. A little bit different than the New York City subway system, isn't it?
Well, yes. But, you know, there have been days where the time it gets go from one point to another could be an hour, maybe two.
Yeah.
It could feel like it's more. So
it could feel like more.
During the summer, it's very warm. So, yeah. But the view is much nicer here in Laramie than it is here in the Bowery Station or Green. You know, yeah. Greenpoint. Yeah, I think Laramie was better. Sheridan even.
Yeah.
Hey,
well,
you guys will have
to make it out sometime and take the tour with me. Chris and Kirk, you'll have to take a week off and we'll go see some sites that you won't believe.
I've been to Laramie many, many years ago. I almost bought a radio station there like 30 years ago, and technology at that time just wouldn't let us run it remotely. I wasn't 30, but probably 25 years ago. And then somebody, in fact, it was a station that was called K-Moose. Do you know K-Moose?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I almost bought K-Moose.
That was in Cheyenne. Cheyenne, I believe.
No, well, maybe they moved the moniker, because this was definitely in Laramie.
It could be. Yeah. When we moved there in the mid-90s, it was K-Moose in Cheyenne.
Ah, okay. Okay, well, maybe they moved it not long after we looked it by. Anyway, technology wouldn't let us do it just yet. Hey, we got a quick message, and then, Paul, once again, I forgot to advise our guests that we'd like to get a tip of the week from you, and we didn't get to cover quite all of our topics, so I think you can probably come up with a good tip of the week for us in just a minute. This Week in Radio Tech, our 512th episode, it's Kirk Harnack and Chris Tobin. We're talking to Paul Montoya, the Director of Engineering at Wyoming Public Radio. And our show is brought to you in part by Angry Audio. And don't get mad, get angry. And if you've got a studio and so many of us are working from home, you need to get a telephone hybrid or hybrid type behavior at your home studio. I'm telling you, this is the bee's knees and the cat's meow. It's the Bluetooth audio gadget from Angry Audio, because this will connect right up to your cell phone. You connect this to your cell phone, you get two-way audio. Here, you look at the backside of this. Into and out of here with these professional connectors. You've got AES connectivity for coming out, and you've also got analog connectivity. So whatever you need to hook up to, it's stereo. So if you want to play stereo music out of your smartphone, comes right out of here and goes into your console. If you want to do phone calls, of course, those are mono and they use a low latency mode there. This is just really so cool for getting hybrid type action. You can get callers on your audio console, on your podcast, on your radio show. And hey, you know what? Check this out. If you are using an app that gives you better audio quality than the public switch telephone network, let's say you use Facebook Messenger or Skype, or any kind of app that gives or WhatsApp, and you want to do a call with one of those apps or even FaceTime, you know, the audio is better on those apps than it would be over the public switch telephone network. Well, that same high quality audio goes right into your audio console at your home office or at your home studio, even, you know, back at the radio station, if you ever get to go back there. So I want you to check this thing out. It costs less than you might think. I was surprised at the price of this thing. It is definitely less than you might think. Go to angryaudio.com on the web. It's the astonishing new Bluetooth audio gadget. So much better than taping your phone to the microphone. Oh, my gosh. And so much better than the speakerphone. Thanks a lot, Angry Audio, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. And I highly recommend this device. You're really going to love it. I've heard from a number of people who say that they bought one, they're using it, and it's working just really well for them. All right, Paul, I'm going to put you on the spot and see if you can give us a tip of the week. Can you tell us what we should walk away with?
Well, my tip would be probably something that fits well with the whole mountain cowboy experience. And it's an old saying that I heard years ago. Maybe it was John Wayne that said it. But keep your powder dry. And, you know, it naturally refers to when people are using powdered rifles. If the powder was wet, it wouldn't fire. And it's kind of something that I don't have to tell a lot of you, because I know everybody kind of does this automatically if you're a broadcast engineer. But a lot of times if I'm got windshield time, a lot of times driving that route that we were looking at there, or in the shower, you know, who knows, whatever your best time is, try to anticipate things that can go wrong. And it's not always easy, but the longer you do it, the more you can kind of tend to anticipate. And I think it fits in well with what we were talking about this week, Kirk and Chris, in that, a part of it is just preparation and being ready. And I think that's what broadcast engineering is really about. It's about being ready for the things that do go wrong.
That is a great point. Great point. It sure is. And Chris, I know when you're headed to a transmitter site or even to a studio where you know there's trouble and you have an idea of what the trouble is, you get to think about what you're going to do when you get there. Chris, do you have that tip or any other tip for us today?
Well, since we were talking about generators and business continuity, one thing to remember, if you're doing generator maintenance, it's one thing to check oil, radiator fluids, the housing. But you know what you have to check the most important thing? How is it performing under a load? Measure the current, measure the voltage, measure the time it takes to spin up to proper speed to get the proper voltage. These are things you need to verify, because a lot of times we forget that we start plugging things into an outlet in your studio or complex and forget that, oh, that's the generator circuit, and we've got 6 refrigerators plugged into that as well and other things going on. But right now it's on utility power, switches to generator, and guess what? That generator now starts coughing up very little voltage. Check it out. I've been in that situation where I worked at a facility. Nobody paid attention to the orange outlets that were generator only. Generator circuits. And when we went to generator one day for a load test, wow, we blew 2 breakers. The governor stopped. The generator went to alarm. And the generator technician was like, wow, that's interesting. I've never seen that before. We overloaded the generator. We were asking for more than it can deliver. And think about it. You're asking for more than it can deliver from a dead stop rotating motor to when it spins up and then switches. It's that inrush current. We were lucky we didn't blow out anything else. So yeah, generator maintenance is not just making sure it turns automatically, fluids are right, but check the voltage and what it's doing. And you'll be surprised that you're not at, say, 50% capacity opposed to 90%, which then you're in trouble. So, look for that. That's my tip, along with keeping your powder dry, and don't forget your burning daylight if that's the case.
Yeah. Burning daylight, powder dry, indeed. I wish we could keep on talking, guys. We have got to go. It's time for us to draw this program to a close. Paul Montoya, I want to thank you for being here, and I'd like you, if any of us do get to Laramie, what's the name of the bed and breakfast that we ought to stay at?
Well, yeah, we're just on the west side of Laramie, up in the mountains of Laramie Range. It's called Vista de la Luna. Being a Montoya, I appreciate the view of the moon. Vista de la Luna.
Vista de la Luna. I'm sure there's a website. We'll put that in our show notes. And anybody, you engineers going to Laramie, hey, you're going to have a good time at Vista de la Luna, especially if Paul will spend some time with you, you know, with a cup of coffee over breakfast, yep, or maybe a strong drink at the fireplace in the evening. So,
absolutely. Thanks for having me, Kirk.
It's great to have you with us. Chris Tobin. Chris Tobin, thank you for... Oh, hey, and Paul, your tape's about to run out. Look.
I know. I got to go get it.
Chris Tobin, thank you for being here as well, too. We appreciate you.
You're welcome, Kirk.
And thank you, Suncast, for producing the show this week in Radio Tech. Thanks also to Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network, home of lots of fine podcasts. And I really want to appreciate, are you watching this on YouTube, please click the like and subscribe to the This Week in Radio Tech channel. That does help the algorithm. If you want to make a comment, post a comment in the comment section. We appreciate that too. That would be just great. You can always send us a message also at the website, thisweekinradiotech.com. I do get those, and sometimes we even answer them. So actually almost all the time I do. So thanks a lot. Tell your friends, tell your neighbors, and tell the sponsors of the show that you enjoy our show. That's a really big, helpful thing. Thanks a lot. All right, we got to go. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.